Thanks for joining us for Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And I'm excited for this episode. How about you?
I'm excited about this episode, too. I am particularly excited about this episode.
And I'm excited because I'm going to be in the hot seat for this week's Number of the Week.
Ooh, you are. That's right.
So what do you have for me?
So Number of the Week this week is 12. Alternately, it could also be viewed as 12 billion. Tracy, any guesses?
Well, when you initially said 12, I was going to guess that it had to do with the minimum wage proposal before Congress, which, shout out for that, would increase the minimum wage by 68%. But if it's 12 billion, I don't know what that is. What's the answer?
There's a slight discrepancy between 12 and 12 billion.
Yeah, I was going to say, you initially gave me a good lead in, but the billion threw me off. Billion.
We all know my math skills.
I know. 12 billion is the number of listeners we have, right?
Oh, good guess. Good. That, actually, I think that's it. That's it.
Yay! Okay, what's the real answer?
Although we hope that's true. 12 billion is the number of pounds of cuts that are currently underway in Britain's welfare system. And given the outcome of the UK elections last week, it looks like that's actually going to happen in the months and years to come.
That's a startling number, 12 billion. But you know, this is also timely, though, because we have a great interview that's related to the UK elections and the US.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have with us this week Mary O'Hara. She's a reporter and a columnist for The Guardian newspaper. And she is going to be speaking with us about the outcome of the UK elections, as well as her book, Austerity Bites, which actually takes a look at the human toll of the cuts that have been happening in the austerity regime in Britain.
And we're also going to be joined by Tiana Gaines-Turner, who's with a fantastic group, Witnesses to Hunger. She'll be talking with the editor of TalkParty.org, Greg Kaufman.
Him again?
Yeah, we invited him back.
Who did that? We'll also have the weekly Ish Worst with Alan Pike, deputy editor of Think Progress.
And last but not least, we'll be joined by my friend Maya Dusenberry, who's one of the editors over at Feministing.com for their editorial work. She'll be joining us to discuss why women are disproportionately impacted by poverty.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. I'm extremely pleased to have with me Mary O'Hara, award-winning journalist and columnist for The Guardian. She's also the author of Austerity Bites, A Journey to the Sharp End of Cuts in the UK. Mary, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
So, Mary, the UK recently had a very important big set of elections just last week. Can you maybe bring us up to speed? Who were the candidates for Prime Minister? What was the outcome, and what do the results mean?
This was one of the most important elections Britain has seen for a very long time. As soon as the election was held, it began to be described as historic from all sides of the political spectrum, and that's because it was. We had a coalition government in the UK for 5 years up until this election, and that was with the Conservative Party in the majority and the Liberal Democrats in the minority party position. David Cameron was Prime Minister, and Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrats was the Deputy Prime Minister. Now, what happened in this election was, despite all the polling data suggesting that the Labour Party, which is the official opposition, that is the party with the most seats in Parliament, other than the people in power, being roughly neck and neck. There was a real sense last week that it could go either way, but everyone felt that there would be a hung parliament, as in there'd be no overall majority. Now, what happened was David Cameron's Conservatives not only took a lead over Labour, but actually got a majority, the first time the Conservatives have had a majority in 18 years. It was earth-shattering in many ways because a lot of the pundits had got it wrong, because the pollsters had got it wrong. So pretty shocking stuff. Also, a lot of smaller parties began to take greater shares of the vote, and that is not a normal situation in British politics. It's normally a sort of polarity between the Conservatives and the Labour Party.
And the previous government, which now has been effectively reelected and with a heck of a share of the votes, they really had become sort of synonymous with an austerity regime. It's something that's received international attention and a lot of attention here in the United States media. Can you talk a little bit about the austerity that we've seen in the UK, and do you expect more of that with the outcome of the elections?
Yeah, I mean, this is such an interesting point, because one of the major fissures that was running through British politics up until the election was to do with government cuts under a banner of austerity. When the coalition government came to power after the financial crisis, their response was to introduce a whole swathe of austerity policies, including cuts and reforms to the welfare system, which were highly controversial. And unlike, say, countries like Spain or Greece, they weren't instructed to do so by the IMF. They were actually voluntary actions on the part of the British government. Now, huge cuts, billions of pounds of cuts have already gone through, including cuts that target specific groups. So disabled people, single parents, people who were already vulnerable and in need of state help were hit hardest over and over and over again. Now, with the Conservatives now having a majority, the fear for many people is that another promised £12 billion of cuts is about to come through the pipeline, and that will hit exactly the same vulnerable people all over again. There's no sign that those cuts won't come through. So it's a wait-and-see kind of moment right now to see just how bad they'll be and who specifically will be hurt the worst.
And we now have extensive evidence that austerity is really a failed policy. It slows and has slowed in both Britain and in the United States recovery from economic downturns. It compromises job growth and so forth. But what you've done with both your book, Austerity Bites, and your continued journalism is to really focus on the human cost of austerity. Can you maybe give us a few examples of who suffers from these cuts?
Yeah. I mean, that's entirely right. I think sometimes the human fallout of austerity policies gets lost in the sort of wider political rhetoric. You know, all the talk is about deficits, getting deficits down, dealing with government debt. But when it comes to real people on the ground, actually what you're talking about is very significant changes in people's lives. So, for example, in the United Kingdom, One of the most visible signs of austerity policies over the past 5 years has been the rapid rise of food banks. Now, food banks were barely ever heard of in the United Kingdom because the social safety net was regarded as something that actually was enough to, you know, feed your family or keep your house warm. But the number of people going to food banks out of desperation now is hitting the million mark. When I started writing my book, it was at around 500,000, and that was only 2.5 years ago. So this is a doubling of people who need food banks. A lot of the people who are turning to them are disabled people who are, you know, may have some part-time work or may not, are young families who have been hit by changes in the employment market. Again, very similar to the US in that when the crisis happened and the jobs market was badly hit, the recovery in jobs was very different to the recovery at any other election, in that a lot of part-time work, low-paid work, underemployment. And that has meant that people can't make ends meet in their full-time or part-time jobs. So they're turning in desperation to other things. I've spoken to people all over the UK who've had to turn to food banks. And for a lot of people, it's incredibly stigmatizing. It's not something they've had to deal with in the past, the idea of turning up with your hands out begging for food. And a lot of people in Britain in particular would refer to this as something like the Victorian era, going back to a time when the state has completely stepped back from supporting people. Now, Ian Duncan Smith, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, who's the main architect of welfare reform in Britain, would argue that that's absolutely not the case. He would say that his reforms and the government's reforms, and there are more to come, will make it easier for people to find work and easier to get themselves out of poverty. So far, that is not the evidence. So far, what is happening is people are relying on help from churches and from charities in a way that they didn't do before. The jury is still out on whether his reforms as a whole will help people be able to support themselves.
And Ian Duncan-Smith, whom you mentioned, has now been announced he will be staying on as Welfare and Pensions Secretary after the election results have shaken out. And he will be there to oversee the continuation of those £12 billion in cuts that you mentioned, some of which have gone into effect. But actually, many conservatives have been quoted in media saying that they never really thought all of those cuts would actually ever happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, there was a sense before the election that it would be a hung parliament. So there was a sense that the Conservatives would say that they would introduce this new £12 billion worth of cuts, but that they wouldn't be able to because they'd be restrained by a coalition partner. Now, obviously, that isn't the case. So the question is, how much of this will they actually introduce? They've made big financial commitments in other areas. They said they're going to put more money into the NHS because that's a very important issue for the British public. And there are a lot of questions about the economic viability of these cuts. But one of the really important aspects of this that may not be reported much outside the UK is where the cuts fall. So, for instance, over 50% of the welfare budget in Britain goes to pensions. Now, the government in the coalition protected pensioners from cuts, in fact, gave them guaranteed rises in their state pensions. That's going to continue, which means that the cuts have to come from very small areas. A leaked document came out a few days before the election, which hinted that some of the areas that will be cut would be vital child benefits. That creates worries about increasing child poverty. There were even musings on the idea that they would cut state maternity pay, something that would have been seen as an absolute no-go area. So they have to be very targeted because they have protected other areas of welfare and social security. So it's going to be really interesting to see just how far they can go without breaking the backs of people.
And you mentioned the child benefit. I mean, something that the UK has in place that the United States can barely even dream of is by law, there is actually a child poverty target. There is a date certain by which the government is required to end child poverty. Are these cuts going to mean a step backwards? Will the country be unable to achieve that goal?
It's impossible to see how they can reach that goal under the current circumstances. The original targets for child poverty were put in under the previous Labour government, which actually reduced child poverty quite significantly during its time. Now, when the previous election happened, the Conservatives said that they would stick to those targets, that they would reduce child poverty. But organisations like the Child Poverty Action Group in the UK have worked incredibly hard at trying to understand how this could be possible. And they have pointed out time and again that policies like reducing child benefits, reducing housing benefits, and other things that directly affect families have a massive impact on child poverty. And if child benefit is about to be cut again, then that could have significant impact because the families who benefit most from that are the less well-off, are the working poor, and are people who maybe the mother is a carer of a disabled child, for instance. And this is a vital sum of money to get people from week to week. I mean, you're talking here the difference between having food in your cupboard and not having food in your cupboard. That's what it means.
And you mentioned cuts that specifically target people with disabilities. I have definitely been following with interest the pattern of cuts and what they've meant for people with disabilities across the pond because of a lot of the work that I do here on the United States disability programs. Can you talk a little bit about what those cuts have meant and whether you see any traction to try to mitigate them or maybe with the election results there's no hope?
There are two different aspects to what's happened with disabled people in the UK. One is to do with the reforms of Social Security and Back to Work initiatives, which have seen many disabled people, hundreds of thousands, go through controversial Back to Work evaluations where they have been told that they're fit for work and then 40% of the appeals have proven that they have been misjudged as fit for work. Now, often during those processes, people are sanctioned if they don't take up a job. So that has meant that people have lost vital income by being sanctioned for not turning up for job interviews, for example, for jobs that they can't actually physically get to. So there's that side of it which has impacted their income. And then there have been cuts to specific benefits that were designed for disabled people. One of the most prominent among those is something called the Independent Living Fund, which is a fund that was set up coming up to 25 years ago, to offer extra assistance to the most severely disabled people in the country. Now, this was widely regarded as one of the most important steps forward in giving disabled people an equal status in society, keeping them out of institutions, enabling them to live in their own homes. The government has abolished that. As of now, that fund no longer exists. Now, the government says that local authorities, so local councils, will be able to find ways to support the people who will no longer have that fund. Disabled activists and campaigners argue that, of course, most of the cuts that are hitting them are coming through local government. So local government doesn't have any money to create extra funds for people. And there's a real and, you know, very valid concern that in 18 months, 2 years' time, lots of disabled people who were being helped to live independently and contribute in all kinds of ways to their society are going to be prevented from doing that.
And some of the news stories that have made the biggest splash, and which are, of course, the most tragic, have been of people who have been judged, quote, fit to work, as you said, and who have then subsequently died while trying to actually mount an appeal.
Well, this, again, is an extremely controversial area. So just before the election, a candidate from the Green Party, one of the anti-austerity smaller parties in the UK, put it to Ian Duncan Smith that up to 80 people had died directly as a result of welfare reforms. So, for instance, if you have a mental illness and you are deemed unfit to work by your general practitioner, but you get a letter saying you are able to go to work and you can't even leave your own house, then the stress of that can be absolutely enormous. Now, there are very legitimate concerns about making direct causal links between a specific policy and the death of someone. But I think what isn't in doubt is that the mental strain and distress that has been caused by some of these policies specifically, especially the back-to-work policies, has left people in complete despair. There are many families in the UK at the moment who are campaigning to get the government to do a full and proper analysis of the fallout of these policies, because there cannot have been this many deaths and cannot be, as there have been, as I have learned time and time again, increased calls to mental health helplines directly citing these as the cause of distress. Now, there can't be a denial that there is something going on here and that people are deeply, deeply affected by them. And the fact is, you know, people have died, and a combination of things may have caused that, but there's a really good chance that one of those was the back-to-work stress.
So some conservatives here in the United States have been recently looking to the UK as a model for anti-poverty policies. And perhaps the most recent example is Representative Paul Ryan, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, has proposed as his big anti-poverty plan to block grant and consolidate a whole array of vital anti-poverty programs into one single program that would have fixed annual funding. And what he has cited as his inspiration for this idea is the UK's universal credit, which is a new means-tested benefit that has consolidated six benefits, including the housing benefit, the child tax credit, and job search allowance, among others. Can you talk a little bit about the universal credit and what the experience has been, and whether you think it's a good model for the United States to be looking at?
Yeah, well, like you say, universal credit bundles together a number of individual benefits, the idea being, which isn't a bad idea, to make the system more efficient, to not have so much bureaucracy. The idea is that it would be cheaper and it would be easier to run. The second aspect that Ian Duncan Smith would say is that it will promote people getting back into work because their benefit levels will be adjusted to encourage them into employment. Now, in principle, none of that sounds like a terrible thing, except a lot of groups who work in the arena of child poverty, for instance, and other social security arenas are worried on a number of levels, one of which is that it won't actually get people back into work in the way that it's intended. But secondly, that actually its implementation has been absolutely chaotic. It was supposed to be in place like 2 years ago nationally, and it's still not in place regionally. So it has been an absolute nightmare for Ian Duncan Smith But the jury is very much still out on universal credit. And I imagine that conservatives here are watching those developments very closely. But what they need to keep an eye on is just how difficult this has been to introduce.
And also how different the United States policy landscape is from the UK, right? I mean, your tax system, which is effectively what all of the universal credit benefits are administered through, have a monthly tax delivery system compared to the United States, which does it on an annual basis. So it's always struck me as sort of trying to plant an orange tree, in soil that might be better fitting of, a cherry tree.
Well, that's right, because you can't just sort of completely lift and transplant the system into another country. But there is a tradition, as you all know, of conservatives on both sides of the Atlantic looking to see what each other are doing. And there is a tradition with the Labour Party in the UK looking to see what Democrats were doing. So, for instance, when tax credits were introduced here, that found favour with Labour progressive politicians in the UK. There's always this cross-cultivation going on. I think the danger is when something is heralded as a sort of panacea, as something that will solve a particular issue. You've always got to put up a red flag when something like that is said, because there will inevitably be difficulties along the way, especially when the tax systems and the social security systems are so vastly different.
My producers are laughing at me, so I think my metaphor about the orange tree may have failed. That being said, I do, though, find it fascinating that conservatives cherry pick the policies that they, I should stay away from fruit, that conservatives, they love to cherry pick the policies that they want to use as cover to make the cuts that they want to make. I'll just to put it bluntly, I mean, they could take as lessons from the United Kingdom, for instance, raising the federal minimum wage and indexing it to inflation, or making sure that all low-income people who rent their apartments are guaranteed means-tested housing assistance. I mean, the comparison in the United States is that only about one quarter of eligible low-income renters actually receive help, or, for instance, making sure that all prescription drugs are free for everyone, right? These are things that we would love to have in the United States, I can say as someone who's progressive, but for some reason we don't hear those policies echoed.
But they're also things that many, many people in the UK are desperately fighting to protect, because at the moment, progressives and people on the left are with arguing that a lot of these things that we have held sort of dear and precious as key social protections are directly under threat right now. And that's not an exaggeration. You brought up housing. Housing is one of the single biggest issues in Britain. It's always a big issue. But right now, there's going to be a cap on housing benefit. So those people who would have been getting more support to rent a property for them and their families are going to find that dramatically reduced. And that is having a huge impact. Rents are soaring through the roof because the property market for purchasers is soaring through the roof. This is one of the most important issues in Britain right now, affordable housing, and what role the government has in that. And it's seriously under threat right now.
So a television show that you told me right before we got on the air, actually, is about to begin its second season in the UK, is called Benefits Street. And it takes a look at it. It's a reality television show, right? So it's following people who are struggling to make ends meet and who need assistance from the government to do that. But it really does it in a way that's sort of poverty porn, right? And it really maybe bears very little resemblance to the people that you've been discussing. Can you talk a little bit about that show and maybe what it says about the myths that might be fueling the policies that you've just described?
Yeah, well, I mean, poverty porn is the term that has been used to describe shows like Benefit Street. And for people who haven't seen it, essentially, it takes a look at one street in one city, and a certain number of residents in that street signed up to be followed and filmed in their everyday lives. Now, the accusations leveled against the show are that it's voyeuristic, that it's unrepresentative, that people who live in that street who don't want to be filmed aren't being filmed, so how can it possibly depict real life? It's very highly selective. Now, what it does is feed into what has been an incredibly successful narrative during the past sort of 5 or 6 years, which is this idea that if you are in receipt of state help, then you are, in inverted commas, a scrounger, a a skiver. That you are someone who has no interest in going to work. You're, you know, this idea of an entitlement society where you're happy to live off other people's tax. Now, what we do know is that this group of people is so small, like so tiny, and yet they get this extraordinary amount of publicity. It creates an impression for people that anyone who gets state help is somehow undeserving and illegitimate, and they have no intention of contributing to society. Now, from my experience of going around the country, talking to people, and just living in the country, I know how rare these individuals are, but they are presented as the norm. And what that does is make people very anxious about the welfare state, about social security. They see everyone who's in receipt of benefits as somehow feckless, despite the fact that millions of people need help from the state. And that it's usually the working poor, it's people who are getting up and going out to work every day, who need child benefit, need tax credits. So it creates an extremely distorted picture of what it's like to be living poor or on the poverty line in Britain. And the characters in a show like Benefit Street, and I say characters because they've become like sort of national icons almost. I mean, they're a lively, interesting bunch of people. And, you know, some of them, their lives are very difficult. And, you know, some of them are quite enjoying the limelight. But that's not to say that it's representative. But a lot of people watch it, and then it gets reported in the newspapers. It's fed into a narrative that has propped up the justification for further cuts.
Mary, I think we're going to have you back to continue this conversation and continue to compare what's happening here with what's happening across the pond. But tell our listeners where they can find more information about your book.
Yeah, well, they can find more information about the book at the website, which is austeritybiteuk.com. And you can find out all the reviews and where to get a copy.
Well, we all look forward to reading it. Thanks so much, Mary O'Hara, award-winning journalist and columnist for The Guardian, as well as the author of Austerity Bites.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Greg Kaufman, editor of TalkPoverty.org. I'm joined now by my very good friend, and a friend of the show, Tiana Gaines-Turner. You might know her from various media appearances, including a few on Melissa Harris-Perry, her congressional testimony, or her advocacy through Witnesses to Hunger in Philadelphia. But if you don't know her, you get to meet her right now, so you are lucky. Welcome, Tiana, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thank you to all the Talk Poverty listeners.
As I mentioned, you're a member of Witnesses to Hunger in Philly. That's a group of mostly women who use photographs and stories to document their experiences in poverty and then advocate for change at the local, state, and federal levels. You guys are now in, I believe, more than five cities and expanding?
Yes, that is true. So Witnesses to Hunger has been up and running since 2008. The founder and chief executor on the program is Dr. Mariana Chilton out of Drexel School of Public Health, the Center for Hunger Free Communities. And Witnesses to Hunger is right now. We are in Boston, Baltimore, Camden, Martha's Vineyard, Washington, D.C., trying to start up in California, Texas, and Alaska.
Wow. And your work is what do you do primarily with Witnesses?
Basically, my job is to be an advocate for those who don't have a voice. I speak out and I let, you know, policymakers, mayors, anyone who basically makes change and has the authority to execute what's going on right now in the United States for low-income families who live in poverty, we basically go out and we testify and we use our photographs to help them to understand the struggles of hunger and poverty firsthand. So they say, you know, graphs and a lot of words, but I feel like photographs says 1,000 words to look into a child's eyes and see the hunger or a mother depressed because she's struggling or a father who, you know, works tirelessly but yet and still can't provide for their families. All of that is being portrayed in our photographs.
Well, and I've seen the exhibits of Witnesses to Hunger and you guys travel around, and I would say to our listeners, if you ever get a chance to see any of these exhibits, you absolutely should. And you all recently organized a congressional briefing with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro's office.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that and what the briefing was about and how it went?
Well, the briefing was really good. It was a briefing basically for us to have a conversation with a lot of the congressional staffers on both sides, Democrat, Republican, Independent, for us to basically talk about summer meal programs. As you know, soon schools will be letting out, and a lot of children who are in low-income neighborhoods get free lunch and free breakfast through schools. But no one thinks about the fact that when schools are out, those are two meals that, you know, low-income children no longer can depend on. So the summer meal program is very much important. And it's also important for your listeners to understand that in the inner cities, we do have summer meal programs, but in some other places, like my Witness to Hunger sister, Joannis Cruz, let us know that in Pemberton, where she lives, New Jersey, there is no summer meal program. So what we're trying to right now advocate for is that during the summer months, whether you receive SNAP, which is food stamps, or not, that parents can be able to receive a certain amount each month to help out for meals, for the healthy nutritional meals for their children in the summer months. We also were talking about, you know, WIC, which is a program that mostly helps women, infants, and children.
Right.
We were talking about safe and affordable housing, which is one of the biggest things that we advocate for. The waiting list for Section 8 and public housing is just far too long, 10 years, 13 years, which I know firsthand through to my own self, you know, waiting on the waiting list for 10 years with three children with medical disabilities. It was difficult. You know, me and my husband, we were homeless twice. It was difficult to, you know, go down there every single day for maybe, I think I commuted an hour and 45 minutes, close to 2 hours, to go down to an office every day and advocate for myself to find out why, you know, I hadn't been placed up on the list yet. So
you mentioned your experience with homelessness, and I remember when you testified at Congressman Paul Ryan's hearing on the War on Poverty programs. And by the way, he held five hearings with 17 witnesses, and you were the only person who actually ever lived in poverty who testified. You were invited by our friend, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, to testify. But anyway, you spoke some about your experience with homelessness. One thing that really struck me was both you and your husband had jobs at the time you were testifying. There were more than a few members, conservative members, who kept telling you that your ticket out of poverty is a job. And you kept telling them repeatedly, well, I have a job and so does my husband. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the fact that they sort of were repeatedly either not hearing you or tuning you out? How did that make you feel, and why do you think that that was happening?
Well, first I would like to say thank you so much to Barbara Lee's office for inviting me to come out to be an expert witness on hunger and poverty to speak for so many Americans who go through this. I don't look at myself as an expert. I just look at myself as an advocate. And, you know, I would also like to thank the Republican House Budget Committee and Paul Ryan for, you know, inviting me there. That was a tough time for me. At the time, I was facing, I had a kidney infection on my left side, so I was in a lot of pain. But I fought through it, and I went. And I feel like a lot of times people who don't understand like to make excuses to point fingers at people, if that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
for them to try to basically bully you with words. And that's how I felt at some point, that I was being bullied, verbally bullied by, you know, them calling me lazy or, I mean, and basically in so many words, you know, that's what they were trying to say. That's what other people have tried to say. And they were just kept saying, well, if you get a job. And I keep saying it over and over again. You know, as you said, me and my husband both work part-time jobs.
Right.
But yet and still, we still struggle. We still live underneath the poverty level. And yet and still, we still try to make ends meet each month. Neither one of us are lazy. You know, I feel like people who work in poverty are some of the hardest working people. And the fact of that right now, most Americans work for a minimum wage, and that's exactly what it is because it's a minimum wage, that's a problem. We need a living wage, 10 an hour. We need sick paid leave. We need to be able to make sure that there's no child, senior, or veteran that comes home from the war, you know, loses their houses to foreclosure or doesn't have enough food to feed them to feed their families every day.
Right.
And, you know, at this time, my husband does work full-time. I was laid off the first week of April, so right now I'm currently looking for work every day. But it's a constant struggle. You know, people say the safety net. Well, if the safety net has ginormous holes in it, then, you know, how is anybody supposed to climb up out of that safety net?
Absolutely. And another thing that I know from knowing you for many years now, I believe like 4 years now,
yep.
is how active you and other people are in your community, just basically helping each other get through day by day. One thing that was striking from that testimony, you were also challenged about that some of the conservative members were suggesting that people in low-income communities are just waiting for a handout, that they're not doing enough to pull together. But that's certainly not your experience in your community, right?
No, it's not. I live in a second congressional district. Due to census numbers, last year was the hungriest district next to the Bronx. And in my community, you know, I'm not going to lie and say we have a lot of violence, we have a lot of poverty, but we have a lot of hope. We work together. We look out for each other. You know, it takes a village to raise a child, and that's what we do. You know, this winter I did a coat drive out of my house. I gave away 175 coats to needy families. I didn't need to know what your income was, what your background was, who lived in your house, you know, any of that. If you were cold and you needed a coat, a hat, gloves, scarf, I helped you out. You know, I feel like a lot of times people say, oh, well, go to your local food pantry and it's the church's responsibility. No, it is the government's responsibility to help out people when they need help. We need to get back to the values and what America is supposed to be built on, helping your brothers and sisters, looking out for each other, and everybody having each other's back. I mean, I'm going to be frank right now, Greg, with everything that's going on right now in Baltimore and the news and everything like that, people are suffering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are tired of being pushed around and bullied. And, you know, it's just, you know, a sad event when we have to turn to violence, you know, to get your point across. But I do feel that in time, hopefully with our new president coming up and with the DNC that's getting ready to come up and also with the Pope coming here to Philly, you know, that things are taking a change in the right direction. And I just want to definitely, me and my Witness to Hunger sisters and my Witness to Hunger brother, because we do have a single father who lives in Baltimore, that we will continue to advocate. We welcome anyone to have us to the table. We don't want a handout. We want a hand in. If you want to know what it's like to walk in our shoes, don't judge me. Don't look down on me. Don't assume that you know what I'm going through. Call me up. Ask me. We can sit down and have a respectable conversation. And we can try to figure out how we can work together to end hunger and poverty, not just in Philadelphia, but for worldwide.
That's fantastic, Tiana. And I have to ask you, you're talking about feeling bullied and people in your community feeling called out in negative ways and in false ways. You know, one thing that's really interested me as a poverty reporter and now editing pieces written by people in poverty at talkpoverty.org is how we most effectively as a community, rich, poor, middle class, all of us who care about these issues, push back against this shaming and stigma of people in poverty. Do you have thoughts about that?
Stigma is a very powerful word, and I feel like, you know, I think that I can shout it from billboards and mountaintops because it's not easy to sit in across the table from someone and let them know that you have problems feeding yourself and your children. It's not easy, you know, telling your story of, you know, where you came from and where you're going to. But I feel like if I don't do it, then, you know, people will live up to the height of the myths. You know, I feel like in a way I'm like, you know, like they have Ghostbusters. I feel like witnesses, we're Mythbusters.
That's right.
You know, we show you through our pictures, we show you through our testimony and our hard work on what we're trying to do. You know, it is very difficult, but I feel like if I don't do it, then who will? And I have no problems with, you know, anyone wanting to call on me and ask me anything, you know, because pretty much, like you said, Witnesses to Hunger, we've been on CNN, Turkish TV, talk radio. So, you know, we basically are out there, you know, and I feel like people just need to, you know, try to understand for a second, take the smoke screen down, take off the rose-tinted glasses, and try to understand exactly what's going on in people's lives and help them to lift themselves up and not put themselves down.
Well, Tiana, I thank you so much for your leadership on this, for taking the time to speak with us today, and I definitely am looking forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you for your work, and thank you for being with us on Talk Poverty today.
Oh, thank you so much for calling me, Greg, and I definitely appreciate it. And I cannot hang up off this conversation until I say on May 19th, people have to get out and vote. May 19th, if you're in Philadelphia, anybody who's listening in Philadelphia or wherever you are in the world, when there is an opportunity for you to push a lever or fill out a ballot or a paper, you need to do so. Exercise your right and vote. It is very important. We do care. People do care. And as long as we push forward, we will have change at the end of the day.
There you have it. There you have it. Philadelphia listeners, May 19th, get out the vote. Thank you, Tiana.
Thank you again. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
And it's time for the almost weekly worst. Woo! I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined by Alan Pike of Think Progress.
How you doing?
Great.
We're great.
We're glad
Alan.
To have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So, Alan, what is it that you do for us for the weekly worst?
So we're going to go through three of our least favorite stories involving poverty and public policy from the last couple of weeks, and then vote on which of them we think is the worst of the three, and then we're going to fight about how the other people who didn't vote the way we voted were wrong.
Excellent.
And you're all going to learn something from it.
The more you know.
All right. Now, what's the first story?
All right. First up is Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who told CNN that the United States has been able to make our poor somewhat the envy of the world. He was arguing that poverty is both cushier and less permanent in America than in places like India. And that's a little bit easy for Issa to say, given that he's got almost a $500 million personal fortune and is a voting member of the party who is averse to funding programs that are proven to help Americans climb out of poverty when their bootstraps aren't enough.
Those bootstraps. Always about the bootstraps. And isn't Issa like one of the wealthiest members of Congress?
Yeah, I it's hundreds of millions of dollars. It's enough money that nobody ever says a specific number. But it's we're talking like Mitt Romney kind of money.
Like, we're really lucky. There's bootstraps just scattered all across this country for poor people to put on and pull themselves up from. Perspective. Yeah,
I don't know how knowing that there's a billion impoverished people in South Asia who have it worse is supposed to put extra protein on your plate or a living wage on your pay stub, but that seems to be emblematic of the mentality here.
As long as it's worse somewhere, it's okay if it's horrible. Here,
exactly.
Right? That's the rationale.
What's your next story?
All right. Next is Wisconsin, where state Republicans are pushing legislation to micromanage poor people's shopping carts by restricting how food stamps families can spend their money. The law would cost a couple million dollars to enforce and prohibit SNAP money from buying shellfish, and make it harder to buy not just junk food, but staples like deli meat and dry beans and spices for cooking.
Wait a second. So we're used to the shellfish thing, but what's wrong with dry beans? What do people have against dry beans?
So part of the problem here is that every time that Republicans try to come up with a way to ban junk food from food stamps families, they can never actually make it work. Nobody's been able to design a policy that achieves that stated end in any sort of clean way. There's no off-the-shelf version of this
to
borrow.
So to speak.
So what they end up doing is they define junk food based on some other list of foods. In the past, people have used like their grocery sales tax exemptions as a stand-in. In Wisconsin, they want to use the list of foods that's prohibited from WIC money, from the Women and Infants mm-hmm. and Children program. So that is a program that's specifically targeted to the nutritional and developmental needs of two-week-olds, and they want to use that to restrict how people can shop at age,
adults.
You know, 86 or whatever.
Okay, so
brilliant. Well, it sounds like they have a really bad idea, but they're also really bad at implementing it. That seems to be the trend here.
Yeah, it's a twofer.
Our food bans aren't working. People are figuring out how to eat still.
Oh, dear. You're just
all right, number three? You guys ready for three?
I know.
Yes. Take us from this one. Bring us to number three, Alan.
To the tropical shores of Honolulu, Hawaii. Mayor Kirk Caldwell recently admitted that his policy of quote-unquote compassionate disruption toward his city's homeless population has failed. He's been criminalizing homelessness, and it's cost the city about $1.8 million just since last summer to do these sweeps of public parks to clear homeless people out. And he's now admitted that because the city hasn't built actual housing units for the people that it's forcibly relocating, he hasn't actually achieved anything as far as reducing homelessness in Honolulu.
Well, that's actually a little bit of a weekly best because he's figured out that his policy failed and he admitted it. I mean, there's all the loss of money and harm to homeless people in the process. But
details,
I will say
details.
That this is the first time that I've, you know, in a while I've heard a conservative admit to a program not working.
Bummer, he's actually a Democrat.
Oh, I hate when progressives are wrong.
That's how they get you.
Oh, then he's even worse.
This is an idea that's bizarrely bipartisan at the local level. There are literally hundreds
true, actually,
of cities and towns across the country who have taken this approach of just lock them up, chase them off our streets. It ruins my lunchtime when somebody asks me for a nickel.
And you all have to vote for that one so I can drop some really good stats on that one. So incentive to vote for the homelessness one, guys.
We're within 50 feet of a polling place, Rebecca. You can't do that here.
Okay, right. So now it's that time to vote. We each get one vote. Now I don't want to vote for the third one. One, because I looked like an idiot, and two, because Rebecca wants to drop knowledge. So I think I'm going to have to vote for Daryl Issa. That one just really bugs me because...
Did you say bugs, Tracy? Wasn't he an exterminator?
No, car alarms.
Oh, car alarms. Oh, okay, right. We just got all of our facts wrong today.
Who was the exterminator currently in
Congress? You gotta drop it.
next week for the Weekly Worst, I will come back with who the exterminator is.
Well, I'm voting for Issa just because there is this, and I actually know he is a conservative, there is this trend of conservatives like to point to countries that at least we're not as poor as them, rather than comparing ourselves to other developed countries where our income inequality here is really terrible and amongst the worst of developed countries. And I think that also we have to look at relative measures of poverty and think about what do we want for people in this country. It's not enough to just say they're better than the worst off in the world. So that's my vote.
Well, that was kind of serious, Tracy. I don't know. It brought down the mood in here. I'm going to vote for the criminalization of homelessness one. And this is in part because it's a trend that we're seeing nationwide, and in part because I wanted to share some of those statistics, as I already outed myself for. So there was actually a study done by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty taking a look at cities across the country. They looked at 187 cities, and they found that a quarter of them have citywide bans on begging. Three quarters actually prohibit begging in particular public places. Half prohibit sitting or lying down in particular public places. And a third have citywide bans on loitering and so-called vagrancy, one of those crimes from like the 18th century. So this is a widespread problem. And it's something that's not only contributing to mass incarceration in this country, but it's also really penny wise and pound foolish, as I hope we have time to talk about on future shows. So there, that was my knowledge, Tracy. What did you think?
I agree with everything you said.
Before I vote, I just have a real quick question for you both. Why are you both so wrong?
Why
aren't you better at voting for the right one?
Why aren't we better at knowing?
Does this mean where it's going to be a three-way tie?
Yes, because I'm voting for the Wisconsin decision effort to micromanage people's shopping lists. This is an idea that was first tried in 2003 by Tim Pawlenty when he was newly elected governor of Minnesota. The USDA has rejected both state requests to do this that it's ever gotten, but it happens over and over and over again, year in, year out, across the country in state legislatures. And again, this is an oddly bipartisan idea, and I think it's something that if you've ever had a conversation, I'm sure you both have, but if you've ever had a conversation with friends of yours about the food stamps program, you've almost certainly heard someone complain about a time they saw someone use an EBT card to pay for, you know, fill in the blank food stuff that they would have enjoyed buying for themselves and couldn't. And I get where that frustration comes from, but to think that you're going to in any way improve the ability of impoverished people who are almost all working a job that doesn't support their family, that you're going to help them get out of that situation, help them earn more money, help them find a better job, help them better their stakes by telling them what they can and can't buy and by making the experience of using an EBT card to put food on their table more humiliating in the grocery store is absurd. And it's also premised on a completely false version of how poor people eat, how they shop, what their dietary intake is as compared to more affluent sections of the population. There's just no justification for this stuff. It's something that makes people sort of feel better. It tickles people's anger buttons. But it's ludicrous. It's not based in the real world, and it's just punishing people who already have it too hard as it is.
So I think we have to wrap this up.
In cases of a tie, we go into the studio and ask Alyssa to be the tie-breaking vote. So drum roll, number one, Daryl Issa. I voted for that. was going to say, I am the weekly worst.
I'm shaking my head vigorously at this. This was bribery somewhere that we didn't see happen.
Since he's not an exterminator, but he has had a fascinating career in the private sector. Can I just tell you guys a little bit about Daryl Issa's background real quick?
You know more about him than I do.
Yes. So Daryl Issa made his money in large part from a car alarm company, which he acquired in a sort of hostile takeover from its original ownership. And this is I highly encourage everybody to do some Googling over the weekend. Spend a happy afternoon reading about Daryl Issa's alleged misdeeds, because he allegedly placed a handgun on the desk of an executive who he was in the process of firing from said car alarm company, allegedly. He was a suspect in a arson investigation at the first factory that he ever owned. And although he was never charged, there are a lot of murky circumstances around that fire, including Issa having increased the value of the fire insurance on the building shortly before it burned to the ground. He's a hoot. He's a real character. He's up until the last couple of years. He's allegedly a real character. I do know that he's a hoot. I've seen it at parties.
We're going to have to, I think, have another time when you're on to discuss what you and Daryl Issa were doing at said parties.
We also need some invites to the kind of parties that you go to.
But I think that we're getting the final hook and have to wrap up. So,
the real hook.
I think if you had shared that information earlier, it would have been a unanimous vote that Daryl Issa is the weekly worst, but I still won by a slim margin. And we'll welcome you back, I guess, in a couple weeks to do this again.
Next week, the
or
week
next
after,
week, whenever.
Whatever's weekly.
Whenever we want.
Weekly-ish, the weekly-ish worst. Thanks.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Given the fact that 6 in 10 poor adults are women, we wanted to discuss some of the reasons women are disproportionately impacted by poverty. To do this, we're joined by my friend Maya Dusenberry, Executive Director of Editorial for Feministing.com. Welcome, Maya.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start out discussing a recent post that you wrote in response to the Fight for 15 campaign around the, raising the minimum wage. In your article, you stated, a livable wage for everyone in this country is one of the most important feminist goals of our time. Can you elaborate on this? Because I feel like that's almost an unusual statement.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was kind of stating it hyperbolically in the hopes that people will kind of take it on as a goal, because I do think it's really important. And I think there has been kind of a really heartening tendency I've seen recently for feminists to kind of take up this cause more than they maybe have in the past. And the primary reason I think the fight is so important is just that raising the minimum wage would just help so many women, and particularly the women who could most use the help. You know, as you said, women are disproportionately impacted by poverty. And while there are many reasons for that, one big one is that they're concentrated in these low-wage jobs. So fully two-thirds of minimum wage earners, as well as two-thirds of tipped workers, are women. And, you know, this over-representation in low-wage industries is a pretty big factor that contributes to the overall pay gap between men and women. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've been glad to see is that there's been a tendency, I think, to talk about the pay gap in terms of the gap within occupations instead of this kind of gender segregation. And I think that makes sense because there's maybe a more widespread intuitive sense that people should get equal pay for equal work, and it's not fair if they don't. And it's maybe a little bit harder to explain that maybe there isn't as much blatant discrimination going on when women end up in these lower paid jobs. But that's still absolutely about sexism. It's not a coincidence that female-dominated jobs tend to pay less in this country.
And you mentioned that women in the feminist movement are increasingly taking on more economic-oriented issues as part of the larger umbrella of feminist issues to focus on. Do you think that's going to continue? Obviously, I think the Great Recession had something to do with that. But it also, I think a lot of people will still critique feminist movements saying that, oh, you know, it's focused so much on reproductive rights, but what about women who have children here? Like, do you think that's a fair criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a fair criticism, but I do think that, as I said, there's been tendency for us to do better. You know, Feminist Thing covered the Fight for 15 from the very beginning, and I think lots of other feminist blogs kind of recognize that economic justice is obviously very importance to women, and that there are these real kind of theoretical links that we can point out. I think the example of domestic workers is a really good one. People who provide childcare and elder care in this country are overwhelmingly women, women of color, who get paid terribly. And the fact that this work is so devalued when it's done by them, by professionals, is totally related to the fact that for so long, this kind of care work in the home was just unpaid labor that housewives and mothers did for free. And so I'm excited to see us really take up this fight.
And while I framed calls for more reproductive justice as something that people might criticize about the feminist movement in ignoring more economic justice related issues, reproductive health is obviously an economic issue as well. And while the public is primarily concerned with traditional economic issues such as minimum wage and job creation, the new Congress is focused on abortion restrictions from, you know, day one. But can you explain why reproductive justice is actually an economic issue?
I mean, the short answer is just that, you know, kids are really expensive. In the best of circumstances, people are, you know, making the choice to have them and are happy to pay those costs because, you know, having a kid enriches their lives in other ways. But yeah, there's just kind of no getting around the fact that having a baby means feeding and clothing and housing another person for more than 18 years. And, you know, we have to remember that in this country, we kind of add to that inherent economic hardship by offering pretty much no social support for this. You know, no guarantee of paid maternity leave, no subsidized childcare, no universal higher education, and a totally inadequate safety net for low-income families. So, understandably, as a consequence, the data shows that there's a real kind of significant economic penalty to motherhood. You know, there's a wage gap between men and women at every age and among single people and childless people too, but it's really when women have children that we see the gap really starts to widen dramatically. And of course, you know, you mentioned reproductive justice, and that battle, you know, is really kind of a broader battle to change those conditions so that everybody who wants to have a child is actually truly free to do so without worrying that it will sink them into debt. But for now, we are just so far from that reality that, you know, preventing people from being able to choose when and if they have children has real just devastating economic consequences. And there's been an ongoing study at the University of California, San Francisco that really kind of shows this very starkly. They've been looking at women who wanted to get an abortion but were prevented from being able to because they'd passed the gestational limit by the time they got to the clinic. And so they compared the women who were denied abortions with women who were able to get one in the nick of time and found that the women denied abortions were 3 times more likely to end up below the poverty line 2 years later.
And so obviously abortion rights is going to be one of the central issues that comes up in the 2016 election, because that's one of the real areas where there's stark differences between many of the candidates who've declared so far. And you recently wrote about Carly Fiorina entering the race. She declared that her candidacy would somehow negate the idea that conservatives are waging a war on women. And you essentially wrote that she thinks voters are stupid. So why do you think that she's wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I hope that she's wrong. I do think it's a pretty kind of insulting strategy, which we've seen kind of before when they ran Sarah Palin. And I just think, you know, obviously, the American public maybe isn't super up on the policy debate, but I don't think that people are choosing a candidate for such superficial reasons as, oh, I'll vote for a woman even though her policies are totally against mine. You know, like one of the former editors of Feminist Thing, Anne Friedman, wrote years ago that a woman's candidate is not the same as a woman candidate. And I feel like we've used that every election cycle.
Feministing also highlights a lot of important pieces that other venues post, and you link to an ACLU piece titled "Transgender Equality is Not the Post-Marriage Fight of the LGBT Movement." And we know that LGBT people are disproportionately impacted by poverty, and more than a quarter of LGBT people have lost their jobs due to discrimination. So what was it about this piece that you wanted your readers to learn?
Yeah, so one of the arguments the author was making was that there's this kind of tendency in the mainstream LGBT movement that, you know, once we achieve marriage equality, which we've, you know, made some good progress towards at this point, then we can kind of turn our attention to trans rights. And that kind of framing of the issues tends to erase the fact that actually, you know, trans people have been involved in the broader LGBTQ struggle since the very beginning. And just because they're kind of, there's this moment of real kind of amazing trans visibility right now, that we should remember that they've been fighting for survival, fighting for rights from the very beginning, and that, you know, that struggle will continue to go on for a long time. And there was actually a really fascinating NPR article last week about a rebellion by trans women against police harassment in the Tenderloin in San Francisco that happened 3 years before the Stonewall riots. And so that also was kind of making the point that we see trans rights as this new kind of fight just because it's more visible now, but it's actually been a long time coming here.
Our guest is Maya Dusenberry, Executive Director for Editorial for Feministing.com. Maya, thank you so much for joining us and for going through these various issues that impact women and disproportionately impact women living in poverty.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network, or probably on iTunes, because really, who has radios anymore?
And continue the conversation with us on Twitter using the hashtag TalkPoverty and tweet directly at us with the handle @TalkPoverty.
Special thanks, as always, go out to our co-executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman.
And our fantastic intern, Will Strom.
Also the press team and the poverty team.
And as always, our friend, Chris Stiles Bacon.
Take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handle. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S.
You are listening to the We Act Radio Network, produced in Washington, D.C. Visit us online at weactradio.com.